Freudianism, as it relates to literary criticism, Freudian psychoanalysis, really sort of shoots past the text and tries to get to the pathology or the neuroses of the writer.
Welcome to a special essay chat episode of All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm your host, William O'Flaherty. All About Jack is a feature of the website EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm the author of two books related to Lewis that you can learn more about at the end of the show. Today, as part of an occasional series focusing on a single shorter work by C.S. Lewis, and that essay we're going to explore is Psychoanalysis and Literary Criticism. Dr. Corey Latta joins me with this endeavor. Corey's the author of C.S. Lewis and the Art of Writing. Before welcoming him back to the show, let me remind you that we're providing just some highlights of the essay and not trying to do an in-depth analysis of it. Hopefully, if you've never read Psychoanalysis and Literary Criticism, then you'll want to read it, and if you have already, then you'll want to read it again. Well, welcome back to All About Jack, Corey.
Thanks, William. It's good to be back.
Well, before we get into the essay, let me give a quick reminder to the listeners here about the format. I'll begin by giving in a second some background information about the essay. Then I'll have some questions to Corey for him to answer. Next, we're both going to share some favorite quotes from the essay. And then finally, the survey of the essay ends by noting some related works that Corey has picked out. Well, now then, first the background. According to Joel Heck's Chronologically Lewis, Jack gave the paper Psychoanalysis and Literary Criticism on January 28, 1940, to the English Adventurer Society, a literary society at Westfield College in Oxford. This is a college based in St. Peter's Hall, later known as St. Peter's College. It was first published in Essays and Studies in 1942, a journal by members of the English Association. Lewis then reprinted this essay in 1962. That collection is called They Asked for a Paper. That collection is out of print, but you can find it some places and, you know, for used books. But if you want to more easily find it, it's best available in Selected Literary Essays. There it is, the next to last, the 21st of 22 chapters. Well, Corey, now some may wonder why Lewis even bothered to tackle this topic. So why did Jack believe it was worth addressing, and remind us of the historical context in relation to the impact Freud had on literary studies in the late 1930s and early 40s?
Well, first, I think we do well to remember that Lewis was a literary critic. I mean, many of your listeners and many just sort of contemporary Christians know Lewis as the famed apologist. And the writer of, you know, Christian classics, but vocationally he was an English guy. He was a literary critic and a writer himself. So he had his fingers on the pulse of literary criticism, and just about every area, academically speaking, and then in a popular way as well. In the early decades of the 20th century, going all the way to the mid-20th century, Freudian psychoanalysis really just sort of took over. There wasn't a discipline it didn't touch, and literary criticism was no exception. So Lewis himself found Freudian psychoanalysis creeping into his sort of backyard of literary criticism. There is kind of a personal investment Lewis had in this conversation as well. Before he became a Christian, Lewis was a bit of a disciple of Freud, and really gave Freudian thinking and Freudian, I would say, Freudian introspection a hard go. I mean, one of the reasons that Lewis kept a diary was sort of in keeping with an attempt to be introspective and understand sort of the way he operated. And it wasn't until he became a Christian that he began to really reject the materialistic sort of presuppositions on which Freudianism rests. So by the time he started to work through these important textual conversations as a Christian, Freudianism was alive and well and very strong, and he had to contend with it. And Freudianism, as it relates to as it relates to literary criticism, Freudian psychoanalysis, you can imagine, really sort of shoots past the text and tries to get to the pathology or the neuroses of the writer. And that's where Lewis takes issue. So Lewis's sort of first point of contention there is that we can't skip past the text to get to the person. We have to address the text, asking questions like, why and how should we even read this, this poem or this novel, rather than asking questions of why did so-and-so author write this? And that kind of question, that question of the interior, why did this author write this, or why did this author write that, those became, I think Lewis saw those as a threat to sound literary interpretation. So that's really the occasion for Lewis's writing the essay in the first place.
Well, then, so Lewis addresses Freudian psychoanalysis, and also he includes near the end of it Jungian psychoanalysis. Why and what are the differences in these two models of thinking?
Yeah, so this is a bit of an oversimplification, right? But so Freud, and this is what Lewis really kind of peppers in his rebuttal in Psychoanalysis and Literary Criticism, Freud maintained that all art really came out of wish fulfillment, out of this unconscious well of desire. So here I am, I'm a novelist, and I write a story about a man who's down on his luck, who tries to sort of make his way in the world, encounters many struggles, and eventually overcomes them to, live happily ever after, or maybe overcomes them only to be met with greater tragedy, whatever the case. Freud would say that artistic endeavor had my ego all over it, and really probably had, probably had my id, according to Freud, all over it, which would be sexual, latent sexual desires, more animalistic impulses, that my ego, as that part of me that sort of meets society, is always trying to combat. But that work of art would be just this unconscious and then conscious attempt at expressing all these latent, hidden desires. And that the entire artistic endeavor is really one big act of wish fulfillment. So Lewis takes a lot of issue with that. He says, okay, it's not that Freudian wish fulfillment, isn't true or doesn't happen. And Lewis admits it happens all the time. He's never known a time in his life in which that wasn't sort of a running track in his mind, where he, fantasized about being a more popular person, or fantasized about what he might say, or fantasized about more power, more glory, more honor, these kinds of things that the human condition as we know it, presents itself in. But he says there's another kind of wish fulfillment that Freud hasn't addressed and really needs to. So he calls himself sort of making an amendation to Freudian psychoanalysis as it relates to literary criticism. He says that essentially there is the kind of wish fulfillment that has no ego in it whatsoever. He as this, sort of a adorable, and that's the right word because he uses it himself, this adorable idea of what he calls snug town. And he is talking about, the little world of make-believe in which citizens like dress mice and other talking animals and things like that, move and live and have their being. And it's just cute. Like, that kind of world building is just adorable, Lewis says. And one gets lost in it. So, a children's book writer or novelist can create an imaginary secondary world and really project none of his or her own ego or id into that world. It's not really a matter of selfish wish fulfillment. It's more an act of selfless wish fulfillment. So Lewis says that Freud has sort of forgotten that. He also says that because Freudianism deals in symbols, and according to Freud, the symbols of our art, just like the symbols of our world, have sort of patent meaning. For example, the house. Like if you have a house and you think about Wuthering Heights or something like that, the house would represent the human body. Or anytime you have a journey in literature, it's going to represent death. Or kings and queens represent fathers and mothers. But these are always very privatized images, according to Freud. Lewis's major problem with that is, let me back up. So for Freud, if you read Milton, for example, and you feel some sort of, it will feel or not, he would contend that there's some sort of, hypothetically, some sort of latent sexually erotic desire that's being met partially through Milton. That the reading of Milton is such that if you didn't have that latent sexual desire, that eroticism, that the appeal for Milton would be gone altogether. That's sort of a Freudian line of thinking. Lewis is, and that's an individuated, you know, act of wish fulfillment. Lewis's point is, well, if that were the case, then you should be able to take the medium away, like Milton, and just get straight to the expression of that, you know, latent sexual desire, that erotic desire, and come to the same sort of fulfilling outcome. But that's never what we find. If you take the medium away, whatever latent desire that you thought was driving you in the first place seems to not be enough. So Lewis doesn't even really want to argue with latent individual unconscious, you know, desires. He wants to argue with the fact that all that's going on in creating or in enjoying a work of art. He contends that if you don't have that work of art, then the entire experience, latent desires and all, if they're there, falls apart. Therefore, it's the art in and of itself, the act of creativity expressed in the novel, that creates the experience. So Lewis doesn't just sort of end the essay with dismissing, you know, Freudian psychoanalysis. He says there's actually a better model, and that would be a Jungian approach to symbolism and a Jungian approach to the unconscious. So Jung, as opposed to Freud, said, yep, we do have individual unconscious desires, but we also have a collective unconscious. And in that collective unconscious, we have produced myth. So there's a reason why, you know, something like a worldwide flood comes up again and again and again, you know, in these comparative religious texts. Or there's a reason why love or hope or heroism or the hero journey into the abyss or the dark night of the soul, that these things appear again and again and again. And it's because that we as a human race, not just me as an individual with, you know, unconscious individual desires, but we as a human race have, and I think Lewis would, you know, feel safe in saying this, of course, have built in us, created in us, desires that create this kind of collective human pool from which emerges art. So these themes are always going to emerge. They may come in different forms, but love, hope, death, fear, God, the gods, the journey, you know, the quest, sacrifice, loss. I mean, all these things, they're as old as art itself, and they will always be as long as art is. Because according to Jung, they're part of our collective unconscious. So we find in them not just a mirror to ourselves, which is what Freud would contend. We find in them a window to all of humanity. And that's a line of thought, Lewis thinks that maps better onto the readerly experience and the writerly experience of consuming and creating art than the Freudian sort of privatized idea of individual wish fulfillment.
Well, now you've mentioned a little bit about the following, but go ahead and give us some more in terms of the symbols and archetypes that are mentioned by Lewis a lot in the essay here. Why does he do this, and what's their relationship to psychoanalysis?
Yeah, so he mentions, you know, some of Freud's, as I just mentioned, some of Freud's kind of patent symbols, the house, kings and queens, journeys, gardens often represent, you know, sort of the female body and erotic love, intimacy, things like that. And he mentions those things, and he mentions the famous text, The Romance of the Rose, as being this, you know, this work of love and intimate union. And he combats the Freudian idea that these things only exist as the end, you know, for which art is only the means. According to Freud, you could sort of say it this way, that we create art and then consume art just to get to whatever latent, likely even repressed desire, you know, we have sort of bottled up in us. And symbols become the expression of that repressed or unidentified privatized desire. In that sense, we're very reflexive creatures and Freudian thinking. Like, everything I do really brings me back to me. I create only to sort of find myself again. Which, if you're familiar with Lewis's, you know, ideas of hell, sounds pretty hellish. I mean, that to, mm-hmm. to Lewis, this idea of sort of circling back to oneself is a characteristic not of the redeemed life, but of the unredeemed life. Jung, though, says that symbols bring us out of ourselves. They take us out of ourselves into the collective unconscious, and not just of the, you know, of humanity as it is now, you know, living current humanity, but humanity past, humanity present, humanity future. And that, and I would say this, and I think Lewis would too, and that collective humanity is imbued with the spiritual. So these symbols aren't simply neurotically produced. They're more, and this is my language, not Lewis's, divinely given. This is probably a faulty connection in some ways, but they're more platonic than personal. So love is not some sort of, you know, psychological or pathological construction emerging from my family of origin. Love is an abstraction, a truth that I aspire to, like to which I desire to ascend, rather than something I just simply produce that really, in a very circular fashion, brings me back to myself. So in the Jungian model, symbols take us outside of ourselves with the hope that we aspire to them and change in the aspiration. But in Freudian terms, they bring us right back to ourselves. And, you know, Lewis is not a fan of that theologically. He's not a fan of that emotionally, and he's not a fan of that literarily. You know, I'll mention it again here in terms of recommended reads, but I think the text that might be most helpful for understanding this essay is actually Lewis's Experiment and Experiment in Criticism, because the way he discusses reading, it maps very well onto the way he might discuss relationships. So symbols become, according to Jung and what Lewis would endorse, a way to take us outside of ourselves, not entrap us in ourselves.
Now, obviously, as we noted already, that we're not covering every aspect of this essay. I have a digital copy, and the word count is shy of 7,000 words, so it's not, you know, extremely long, but it's a fairly lengthy essay and obviously specialized. But as the title that you just mentioned, and we'll be getting to other things that would relate to this essay, I did find that book, An Experiment in Criticism, very interesting to me. I've only made passing comments here and there, but because of my background is not in Lewis's specialty, some of his specialty things I just don't get into. But because of my background in counseling, I do enjoy this essay. And then because the experiment in criticism is not aimed at a specialized audience, although specialists can enjoy it as well, he makes it very much accessible. So since we are not trying to cover everything, let me have you just in closing for the analysis per se, or an overview of the essay, I guess would be a better way of phrasing it. In closing, address why should those who enjoy the works of Lewis, like more of his Christian apologetics and stuff, or even his, you know, just his fictional works, consider reading this essay on a specialized topic?
Yeah, well, I would say that if you want to understand Lewis vocationally, I mean, the heart of Lewis really was, you know, that of a reader and a writer. So if you want to understand, that was his professional life. So if you understand the way that Lewis spent much of his life thinking, you know, the area in which he labored, you got to get into literary criticism. And this is just a really, really well done essay on conceptions around how to approach literary criticism. So there's a real appreciation for it there, I think, if you want to understand Lewis vocationally. Also, because if you want to understand, you know, the man in his milieu, the writer in his day, I mean, Lewis found himself going up against not just the emerging atheism and the materialism and the positivism of his day, but also the Freudianism of his day. We know Lewis as an apologist, you know, theologically, but we maybe don't give Lewis enough time or attention as an apologist literarily. But Lewis spent quite a bit of time combating poor ways to read, because Lewis believed that the act of reading meant a great deal to what it, you know, what it is to be human. So this is a really, really well done, nuanced, and I would say careful handling of how one should read and how one shouldn't read by Lewis. So I would recommend it for that reason as well. And then I would say, if you want to know a little bit about Lewis personally, you sort of have to infer it here. But if you've read, you know, any biography of Lewis, or Mere Christianity, you'll see that Freudianism meant, if you want to understand Lewis, you have to understand Freud, or at least some of the tenets of Freudianism, because Freud meant quite a bit to Lewis before he became a believer, and then obviously occupied enough Lewis's thinking that he saw fit to write about him a couple of times after he became a believer. So part of Lewis's development took place in Freudianism, and then took place emerging from Freudianism. So to understand Lewis the man, not just Lewis the professional and Lewis the critic and the thinker, but Lewis the man, anytime Lewis writes on Freud, I think we should pay attention.
Well, as noted earlier, we hope that those of you who have read this essay before will be encouraged to read it again, and especially those who haven't, that we've touched on it enough to spark your interest. We want to continue to maybe sparking a interest by sharing favorite quotes. I'll let Corey go first in terms of some quotes that he wanted to share from this essay.
Yeah, thanks. So I got a few here. The first is Lewis says, and I'll give a little context here in a second, but Lewis says that a man who is really hungry does not dream of honeydew and elfin bread, but of steak and kidney puddings. A man really lustful does not dream of Titania or Helen, but of real prosaic flesh and blood. Other things being equal, a story in which the hero meets Titania is entertained with fairies' food is much less likely to be a fantasy than a, quote, nice love story, unquote, of which the scene is London, the dialogue idiomatic, and the episodes probable. And what Lewis means here is, if art were really about just sort of satisfying these urges of ours, these latent desires, why all the extra? Like, why the fantasy? Why the mythic? But when we turn to much of literature, we don't find simply the prosaic or the idiomatic or the realistic. We find the extra. We find the fantastic and the mythic. Because to Lewis's point, art isn't about just sort of scratching the itch or feeding the hunger or taking care of the latent desire. Another quote I like, it says, there are two activities of the imagination, one free and the other enslaved to the wishes of its owner, for whom it has to provide imaginary gratifications. And then another, I thought this was great and very Lewisian to me. Poetry is not a substitute for sexual satisfaction, nor sexual satisfaction for poetry. But if so, poetical pleasure is not sexual pleasure simply in disguise. It is, at worst, sexual pleasure plus something else. And we really want the something else for its own sake. And then the last one that I picked, Lewis says, for we must remember that a story about a golden dragon plucking the apple of immortality in a garden at the world's end, and to dream about one's pen going through the paper while one scribbles a note, are, in Freudian terms, the same story. But they are not the same in literature. And there was one more, since we've talked so much about Freud and Jung, as he includes these two figures. Lewis says, has Jung, in fact, worked us into a state of mind in which almost anything, provided it was dim, remote, long buried, and mysterious, would seem, for the moment, an adequate explanation of the leap in our blood which responds to great myth?
Ah, yes, very good. As I told you before we started recording, I went ahead and selected mine before seeing yours, I really enjoy the ones you picked. One of them is one that I picked as well. There are two activities of the imagination. I won't repeat that. And then I, despite the fact that I'm really big on making sure people have context, when I was more or less skimming back through to pick a quote and seeing what I highlighted, I only picked the beginning part, or the first sentence, where you shared, I think there was three total sentences. It began with, poetry is not a substitute for sexual satisfaction. And I liked how you quickly picked out that the other two sentences after that were ones mm-hmm. that help with the context. But other ones, for me, like if an individual is speaking and they share a short Lewis quote, because they're talking about various things, and unless you really pull something out of context, usually because when you're speaking, you are elaborating different things, and so it can be okay to share a short quote and such, but there are some things that don't stand well on their own. But just like if you're studying for a test and you're going through a textbook, certain things will help remind you of things if you're already familiar with it and such. So for those who are familiar with this essay, some of the shorter ones I'm going to share here will mean more. So I share them to encourage to read the essay to find even more meaning from what is shared here. But so putting that all aside, then here is a quote. Quote, our quarrel is with the man who says, quote, you know why you're really enjoying this? Or, of course you realize what's behind this. Or, it all comes from so-and-so. What we resent, in fact, is not so much the suggestion that we are interested in the female body as the suggestion that we have no interest in gardens, not what the wiseacre would force upon us, but what he threatens to take away. And then a couple of short ones here. Quote, it is one thing to admit unconscious desires. It is another to admit desires so unconscious that their satisfaction is felt as a disappointment and an irrelevance. And then the last one here, quote, I am sometimes tempted to wonder whether Freudianism is not a great school of prudery and hypocrisy. Well, before we close out, Corey, and have you share about other works related to this essay, go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I am a Lewis scholar and most, I guess, notably have written a couple books on Lewis, one called When the Eternal Can Be Met, which is a work on Lewis's theology of time, and then my more popular C.S. Lewis and the Art of Writing, which came out about going on 5 years ago now. And I'm at work on a book on Lewis and the imagination as well. So in addition to my work on Lewis, I try to write creatively and try to spend quite a bit of time doing that. And I teach literature at the college level, and I've also just received my master's in counseling. So I'm now trying to build a practice in counseling and seeing clients. So that's fairly new and exciting for me.
Okay, well, best wishes in those endeavors. So then now, related to psychoanalysis and literary criticism, what are some either other essays or books or some chapters within books that people will want to check out?
Yeah, I think Lewis's besides The Lion, the Witch and Wardrobe, his best known work is going to be Mere Christianity. So I would probably take people there because book three, chapter four of Mere Christianity is called Morality in Psychoanalysis. And that chapter is almost entirely about Freud. Not the literary critical aspects of Freudianism, but the Freud's moral opinions. So I would first go there, and then this is going to require a little more studious of an effort on the part of the reader. But I would say to get into Lewis's letters, go to the index at the end of those collections, those volumes, and search by last name, find Freud. And look at all the times Lewis references or writes about Freud, because it's pretty extensive. I would then go to his. I did mention an experiment in criticism, which I think just parallels what he's doing in this essay so brilliantly. It's pretty remarkable in terms of how Lewis discusses how one should read a text. And what he's saying in this essay about how one should not read a text. I think those works really complement one another. But then I would go to his fiction, because I think Lewis dramatizes the ideas in this essay in Till We Have Faces, A Pilgrim's Regress, and then most effectively, I think, in The Great Divorce, in which we find Freudian, particularly in The Great Divorce, in which we find characters who seem to be demonstrating Freudianism at the level of a neuroses and at a neurotic level. They seem to be modeling the pathology of Freudian desire. And it's not a spoiler alert, I think, for most of your listeners. It does not work out well for them.
Does not work.
No, it does not work out well for them. So I think Lewis apologetically combats Freudianism in that novel, as well as he writes about it anywhere else in his prose.
Okay, and then I'm going to cheat. I have the C.S. Lewis Reader's Encyclopedia in front of me, and in their entry, just after the entry on this essay, but on psychology in general, they do note a couple essays that I know that you've heard of before, Corey, and that is Religion Without Dogma is one essay, and then another essay, Religion, Reality, or Substitute. And so those are a couple of the
Yeah,
shorter
I totally
essays
forgot
there.
about the I forgot about the religious Religion Without Dogma. That's a great essay.
So, yes, definitely indeed. So we encourage everyone to read those and Corey to reread those as well. And again, as I've said it once, I'll say it again. We encourage people to consider reading this essay, Psychoanalysis and Literary Criticism, and you can find it best in the collection of essays entitled Selected Literary Essays. Well, Corey, thank you again for being on All About Jack.
Thanks for having me, William.
Thanks also goes to you, our listener, for your interest in this essay chat edition of All About Jack, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the creator of this podcast. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including a series about quotations credited to Lewis that he may not have written. I also have a YouTube channel entitled Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today you heard my conversation with Dr. Corey Latta on the Lewis essay, Psychoanalysis and Literary Criticism. You'll find links in the show notes on how to read that essay, along with other essays and books mentioned during the episode. Again, there is a link. Additionally, there is a link to an interview I did with Corey about his book, C.S. Lewis and the Art of Writing. And there's also a link to a podcast where I shared a special lecture he gave at the Wade Center entitled Writing Outside of the Inner Ring. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.